The following announcement has been paid for by the New World Order.
Hey, welcome to another edition of the Filthy FRB Show for Sunday, May 17th. And this is a Filthy Tom Lawlor free podcast. It was my fault. My fault on the timing. But we got a show for you this week. And it's with a writer for BloodyElbow.com named John Nash. So, John, how you doing, man?
Pretty good, sir. How's it going?
Oh, not too bad. Now, I mean, I've been aware of you. You know, of course, you're on Twitter. Hey, not the face at Hey, not the face. I believe it is.
Yep. And that's my battle cry. My motto.
Yeah. So, how did you get into this? Because you know, that's a question that I get a lot. I just started as a fan and started going to a bunch of shows. What's kind of your story about how you kind of come to get this voice in the industry?
I was a fan of MMA starting about 2002, 2003. I knew about it. I watched some of the old in the 90s. I'm an old dude compared to everybody else, probably. I'm, you know, early 40s, 42. So compared to most people, I'm much older. And I hated the sport up until I worked on a B-movie in 2002 with Randy Couture and Frank Shamrock. And those guys were pretty cool. But I said, okay, I'll give it a try when Randy fought. And I started watching it, and I actually started liking MMA. So I've been following it, you know, since 2003. Randy versus Chuck Liddell was probably the first pay-per-view I viewed or bought. I watched a few of the old earlier ones, the Sieg ones, but I never paid for it because I thought it was just despicable back then. And then as I was watching, I just, you know, I got interested in, I started writing some hobby stuff, mostly history, because I'm really fascinated with like where MMA started from. So I started some history stuff, and more and more, it gave me a chance. I always wanted to be a reporter, and it gave me a chance to live out my my reporter fantasy, my Watergate reporter fantasy. So as a hobby, I do it on the side.
Sure. So what pays the bills? Or do you talk about that? Or you don't need to talk about it if you don't want to.
What pays the bills, I own a little post-production company, so I do a lot of like commercials and some TV shows and movies, independent movies, stuff like that. And I used to write B-movie screenplays.
Do you know Douglas Crosby?
I know of them, but I don't know him personally.
I'm going to have to introduce you guys.
Okay, so that's the same profession, I take it?
Yeah, he's a stunt coordinator. So he got a lot of those guys into the movie business. Like, well, at least that's what he told me. Like, you know, like Randy and Chuck and Frank Shamrock. He got a bunch of those guys into...
Look up, he worked on the movie I worked on back then, because that's where I met, you know, Don Fry was on it, Dan Henderson was on it. I didn't even know who those guys were at the time, and Gene LaBelle.
Yeah, Fry was another guy that he worked with, and I know he's gotten Chael in on a couple things. I think he's working with Jake Ellenberger on some things.
I've worked on him some stuff. We don't even know it.
Sure, he's a character for sure. But you know, you've really gotten a lot of publicity, you know, for your writing, at least within the past few months, because of the class action lawsuit that's been lodged or filed against the UFC. Give us kind of a quick update. I know you put something out on Twitter, a little bit of an update. Basically, UFC trying not to disclose financial documents. So what's going on with that?
Well, right, yeah, there was a request put in by the plaintiffs that they asked for a bunch of they started discovery. They sent out requests for discovery. And the Zuffa's lawyers, Boy Schiller Flexner, replied, which is, you know, usual. They want to stay on that until there's a decision on the venue and the motion to dismiss. But the plaintiff's argument is that just delays the case. They should get the material, you know, start getting the material now. And it's 59. I mean, it's really what they're asking for is a lot of stuff. A lot of the financials, a lot of statements on, you know, how much they made, how much they paid, who they paid what, their relationship with sponsors, the relationship with managers, all that sort of stuff.
And they
that
even
get it. That's where if the case gets past motion to dismiss, that's where it's really going to get interesting if it starts getting to the discovery phase.
And they want like Twitter account. Like, they want to be able to look at people's Twitter communication of executives.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of normal. I mean, you can get they're asking Twitter to submit it and stuff. But they want all your communications, anything business related. You're supposed to supply that if the court grants it, anyways.
Sure.
But if it's personal material, let's say, someone sending a personal Twitter, email, or text out, that should not be applicable. That should be protected still.
Yeah. The timing of this lawsuit is interesting because I've been told by some sources that last June, 2014, the UFC was close to selling to a private equity firm called the Blackstone Group in New York City. This is a company that handles an incredible amount of assets, private equity, not to be confused with venture cap, a little different. Had you heard about that same rumor, or do you have anything that you can kind of add to that?
I mean, I've heard rumors, and it's funny. I heard the rumor, probably the day before you tweeted it. I think I heard the rumor, but my rumor could be from the same source. My rumor could be just, so who knows? But I heard the same basic rumors that there was an attempted sale, almost exactly what you said. So Dave, where there's an attempted sale the year before, actually two, and that they're trying to sell again, but that keeps popping up, so it's hard to confirm. Is it true? Maybe. Is it not true? Maybe.
Sure.
Until we get more evidence, it's just a rumor.
Yeah, I would imagine everything's for sale if you can come up with the right money. But from one person that I was talking to, Lorenzo was kicking himself for not making that deal last summer with Blackstone because a month later he got news that this lawsuit was coming. Or do you know the kind of the timeline of when he knew it was coming?
So I'm guessing, and who knows for sure, but from people I've talked to, I'm guessing they learned about it over the summer last year.
Yeah, so it kind of makes sense that maybe that negotiations fell through with the private equity firm, and then this lawsuit got kind of thrown on his plate, so to speak. And
I can imagine that if they really were going to sell and they really had a large amount on the table, the price has probably gone down quite a bit with an antitrust class action lawsuit that could, because the treble damages, just the threat of that would lower the price. And now on top of that, an FTC investigation. So if they haven't sold, the price keeps going down.
Yeah, I saw that article. I think Stephen Morocco put it out 2 days ago regarding the FTC investigation. And it was rumored probably, about 3 or 4 years ago that Bob Arum was the guy who got the feds after Zuffa. Have you heard
Bob
that?
Arum got the feds after Zuffa. The original FTC strike force.
Yeah, is that the same as you heard?
From what I understand, the FTC probably initiated it on their own.
Okay, maybe Bob was just trying to act important.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people say the culinary union was the ones that did it, but people miss that too. Is the culinary union wrote that letter months after the investigation started?
Yeah, and then they also said the culinary union was behind this lawsuit, which
is, they're not. The people behind this lawsuit are law firms that sue people. These are people that like making money suing people, so that's,
Yeah, so give us a little bit, if you know, the economics of a large class action lawsuit such as this. How much money is being put up? I assume it's in the millions, several million, because it seems like it's being divvied up between maybe two or three different law firms.
Yeah, I think there's right now, I think there's actually five law firms attached working on it. So it's going to cost them millions to try this. I'm sure they've already spent a couple million too, and they have to go out and get economic experts, and those guys are hundreds of thousands of dollars for their expert opinion to put up analysis and models. So they're looking at, for the full lawsuit, they're looking at, or even just to get through a point of year, let's say, they're probably putting up or budgeting several million dollars, I would guess. I mean, I spoke to other antitrust and class action lawyers just to get an estimate, and they were estimating, that they've already budgeted probably 5 to 10 million for the suit.
When's the earliest you think that some arguments could be heard? You think, heard like 3 to 5 years it could take?
No, I don't think it'll be that long, but it's going to be a while. I mean, right now it's scheduled that in June the court is supposed to settle the venue, and then July 23rd, I think it is the motion, they decide the motion to dismiss. And then after that, we would probably start a few months and sometime in the fall, start depositions and discovery phase will kick in. Then there's class certification comes after that. But they put a schedule out a little while ago, the plaintiffs, what they estimated. I think it was in, they were looking at final settlement 2017. They were expecting that, you know, that's how long the case would take if it went all the way through.
Now, the motion to dismiss, is that just, you know, procedural? Is that, is the UFC saying that they have any particular reason why it should be dismissed, or is that just what happens with these types of suits?
Well, it always happens, because if you're the defense, you want it thrown out, spending no more money. But there is a particular thing they're arguing, which is what you argue in all these antitrust cases, and that's the Bell Atlantic versus Twombly case, which argues that it's not good enough just to argue that a antitrust violation is plausible. That you have to not. I mean, I should repeat, re-say that it's not that it has to be possible. You have to make it plausible. So you have to give enough evidence that it passes a hurdle for the court. And so that's their argument, that this, they did not put a strong enough presentation to pass that hurdle, the Bell Atlantic versus Twombly case. And so that's the dismissal phase. If the court thinks that they put enough evidence forward to pass the plausibility hurdle, then it moves forward.
Yeah, I mean, I gotta believe that there's enough information out there for this to move forward. I mean, they've done so many things that are not on the up and up. Like, off the top of my head, you know, I was reading your article about the history of Strikeforce. I don't know if you recall, Fedor got a deal with Tap Out, right? I think it was for something like $12,000 or $15,000 a month, you know, for 2 or 3 years, something like that. Dana makes one call, and that deal is canceled. I mean, they even put the T-shirt up on the website.
Yeah, that's going to be the argument, and it's where it gets complex for a lot of fans, because nothing's clear cut. It's not that the UFC did this and they broke the law. The UFC did this and they have a monopoly. It's the argument the plaintiffs are making is what's called a monopoly broth, is that the UFC has market power, which you can legally have and not break the law, but they do all these little things that each on their own might be considered just tough business, but you put them together and that's the monopoly broth. You put them, that a certain number of these ingredients put together gives them, is them acting, abusing their market power.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, it's, so maybe the goal, they're not the strict definition of a monopoly, but they essentially are acting as one. Is that kind of?
Well, I mean, you can't confuse monopoly from like economics, where it's complete control of a market, with the with how they consider it under trade law. It's United States law. It's to be a monopoly. There's just some guidelines they have. It's, I guess, market power is used more common now because it's less confusing than saying monopoly or monopsony, and they have to be market power. They have these. Yeah, there's certain things, like if you own 70 or 80% of the market or more, you might be have monopoly power. If you can do what's called a SNP, a small but significant increase in pricing, and it doesn't affect your market share, you might have a they might view that as saying you have market power.
One of the aspects of the lawsuit that I read, I was like, yeah, they're exactly right, or you know, they got something here, is on the likeness. Now, the UFC can use someone's likeness in perpetuity, and that fighter can't get anything from it. You know, I mean, one example, Mark Coleman was put in the video game a few months back, and he's broke, and he got absolutely nothing to be in that video game. I was out in L.A. last week for the Metamoris event. I talked to a guy who's in the UFC, and he told me they sent him a check for $2,500 for EA Sports. And that's it. He's not seeing another check ever again.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard from a lot of guys. I know a lot of guys that were in that failed EA Sports that came up when Strikeforce was around that got more money than the guys that were in the UFC version. And that sold, you know, millions.
yeah.
I don't know. I'm not going to say that proves their monopoly or whatever, they're abusing monopoly power, but I mean, I'm not a fan of that. I'm not a fan that fighters weren't able to negotiate a better deal. I don't think that was good for them, that deal. I think if they would have, you know, if they hadn't been signed, if their rights to the UFC, that THQ and EA Sports would have had to go to all the fighters and pay them a lot more, because people want to play the fighters. They don't want to just play the UFC. They want to play, you know, Carlos Condit.
Right. Now, another thing that was listed in the initial filings was Champions Clause.
Yeah.
What is your understanding? My understanding is that it only extends, you know, like maybe for like four additional fights beyond the end of the contract, or do you have a different understanding of it?
No, it's a little vague, the wording, and it's changed since the last time. Not all contracts are the same, but there's kind of a standard, and back in 2007 it said something like, if you're still retain the belt when the when you're done with your if you have the belt at the end of your contract, or the title, if you're still the champion at the end of your contract, the UFC can extend the contract for three fights or 12 months, whatever's earlier. Then it became three fights or 12 months, whatever's later. And the wording, there's some argument that the wording really, if you read it literally, it means that whenever your contract's done, including the extension, whenever you're still holding the belt and your contract's done, they can extend it another three fights or 12 months, whatever is longer.
Yeah.
In that case, it would be forever. You'd never get out of it.
Right. And it's never been challenged in court. And I got to think that it would be struck down.
I think it'd lose. But if the intent is to make you have to bring it to court after your three fights, then it kind of serves its purpose, because not only do you have to fight three fights, then you got to take it to court, and who knows how long that'll take, and risk the court case.
Yeah, and then don't they have something in the contract that if you sue them for terms within the contract and you lose, you're responsible for their legal bills too?
Yeah, that's they have a venue clause that says if you have debate over the contract or any problems with it, you have to go to Nevada. The Nevada courts. The trial has to be held there, and if you lose, you're responsible for the court costs. And, you know, if you're bringing 20 lawyers from major firms, that court costs skyrocket quick.
Sure. And then, of course, you know, in MMA, you know, 2 years or a year and a half, you're out of the game, it could completely kill your career. You have a very small window to actually make big money in this sport.
Oh, yeah. Most guys peak is, what, three to five years, and they're probably under contract for a good portion of those, and they have maybe one chance to negotiate a big deal. And, I mean, I have a problem. Forget the lawsuit. I just really dislike MMA contracts, not just the UFC. I mean, I think across the board, promoter contracts are just ridiculous in MMA.
Well, I think because everybody steals UFC's contract, right? I mean, hasn't everybody seen one and then just kind of made their own?
Maybe. I mean, I know when a year ago when Bellator was getting in trouble with their contract, they were doing a lot more than the UFC was.
Yeah, the seminal documents?
Yeah, the Bellator contracts I saw a year ago were just, you know, I mean, it was endless how many extensions they could have. Like, you win the tournament and then you win the title, you suddenly got six extra fights added to your contract.
Yeah.
But, I mean, hopefully the ones I've seen recently, the new Bellator contracts, they're nothing like that. They're much more in line, at least with the UFC contracts.
I would just like to see a true free agency, because to me, free agencies in the major sports is so exciting. You know, like, look at that thing, you know, say what you want about LeBron, but in 2010, that was really exciting. Hey, where's he going? You know,
I'm trying to think of the last big free agent, and I guess
maybe Dwight
Anderson, kind of, but even he, I mean, from what I understand, he wasn't, the UFC still had the matching clause with him. He wasn't a true free agent. They still could have matched rights if they wanted to.
If I remember correctly, I think after they couldn't come to terms, they just said, Dan, okay, fine, we're done here.
What I understood too, but then I heard from other people that they didn't withdraw their matching rights.
Hmm.
Even though they said they didn't, you know, they weren't interested anymore, go to Strikeforce. I mean, I guess Dan might have been happy for that, because I meant Strikeforce had to give a pretty good offer. Otherwise, the UFC could easily match for little money.
Yeah, I had heard that the deal was $800,000 per fight.
Yeah, I don't know the exact numbers, but I've heard, you know, similar amounts.
Yeah, which is incredible money. And actually, in your article, I was reading some quotes from Scott Coker that said even with that $800,000 or rumored $800,000 salary, they were still slightly profitable on the fights that Dan Henderson fought on.
Yeah, that's possible, I think. I mean, I've talked to boxing promoters and other people just to go through the Strikeforce numbers, and it, you know, I mean, the definitely the Fader fights cost them, but it wasn't, you know, I think people exaggerate the losses Strikeforce had. Not saying they made a ton of money or anything, but they were, but it's, they weren't Elite XC, they weren't IFL, Affliction.
Sure. I want to get to that, but so I just want to change gears here and just kind of start at the beginning of your secret history of Strikeforce. It's a five-part article. I'll put the tweets out. I think the first part here, just trying to look for the date when it came out. Okay, March. Yeah, on the anniversary of the first show, right? March 10th?
Yeah.
So March 10th, 2006 was the first Strikeforce event. Over 18,000 people at the HP Pavilion in San Jose. And that was many years in the making, as you document in your article. And I'm reading one part here, and I had never heard this. And in 2000 or 2001, MMA was going to become legal in the state of California. And Scott Coker was going to do Frank Shamrock versus Sakuraba.
Yeah, that was the plan, I guess. That's what everybody said. But they didn't have the finance. They didn't. The budget didn't get approved by the assembly in California, so they had to wait.
Yeah. So that was going to be was that. So this is Scott talking. I'm reading from your article. It says Pride wanted to do that fight in Japan. I said to Frank, "Why don't we just do that fight here? Because it's going to be legal in the state." Frank agreed, and then the legislation just kept getting put back. You know, and then I guess it didn't pass until late 2005?
Yeah, and then 2005 they approved, in late 2005 or early 2006. Yeah, the late 2005, and then the first date possible was March 10th. I guess they did it on the first date that was open.
Yeah.
Under the new, after it was regulated, after approved.
So Scott went to the newly formed commission and basically said, hey, I've been promoting kickboxing since the mid-90s on ESPN2, and I'd like to be able to do the first show. Is that basically
I think it was agreed ahead of time because he had such a long track record that he would get to do the first show.
Yeah, and then I guess the second major show was UFC 59?
Yeah, I remember that with the...
In Anna?
In L.A. It's a few months later.
Yeah, with Tito and Forrest and what was some... Was Tim Sylvia on that?
I can't remember. It was 60, what was it, 61 was Hoyce and Hughes? Was that 60?
That was 60 at Staples Center. I think 59 was at the Honda Center.
Yeah, that's right.
And
Back.
The main event's escaping me, but I know Forrest versus Tito 1 was on that one.
Yeah, that was the... That was the co-main.
And then, and then maybe the main was Arlovsky and Sylvia? Or...
It might be. I thought that was...
Yeah, I think I could be wrong on that.
You know, it's amazing. I used to remember all this stuff, and now it's... you know what? It had to be Arlovsky-Sylvia.
Yeah, well, let's just settle this. Let's see, UFC 59.
Sure, it's Arlovsky-Sylvia.
Now they put Fight Night 50. Okay, UFC 50.
Oh, no, right, too. That was, oh, wait, yeah. And that was also, I think, Shirk versus Diaz was actually the co-main.
Yeah, we were right. It's Arlovsky and Sylvia. And Sylvia knocked out Arlovsky. Yeah, Shirk and Nick Diaz. Evan Tanner beat the deceased Justin Levens. Jeff Monson was on there.
Yep, that was two. Rest in peace, both those men.
Oh, yeah. That's something, yeah.
No, it's sad. I'm sad thinking about that card.
Wow.
I was a big Tanner fan back then.
Yeah, that's a shame. So, what now with, where was I taking this? Yeah, so the first show with Strikeforce turned out to be this incredible success. You know, Coker talks about in your article there, like, Dana called him for tickets, and you know he had to open up other sections of the arena late.
Yeah, that's what they. It was. I guess it was a monster success. Everybody was shocked by it. I mean, there was a lot of little. You know, they had Chuck Norris there and some other celebrities, and it was people just kept pouring in. They sold more and more. If you ever saw the old interviews that Frank did back then, he really had the local press wrapped around his finger.
Yeah. So, what was the business structure? Now, from what I understand, it was kind of like an in-house promotion where the HP Pavilion or Silicon Valley Sports and Entertainment would assume some of the financial risk, and then would be, you know, Scott would run it, and he would assume financial risk too. But it was,
yeah,
it was,
I think,
kind
the
of a
first
partnership.
Show was mostly Scott, and he ran up the HP Pavilion before, so it was mostly set up by him. It was later that they became partners, but it was almost built totally on ticket sales, and they did like $1 million gate or close to it, so they had enough to pay everybody. And I guess the big stars, the headliners, I think got a cut of the ticket sales.
And yeah,
Kung Lee apparently still holds the record for most ticket sales.
Really? Yeah. You know, I think people maybe that weren't watching back then, they should realize this thing wasn't on TV.
Yeah, it wasn't. It was just a local event. Local event. I think they recorded it. The Sharks camera crew. But it was. It was originally supposed to be in a ring too. That was a surprising thing.
Yeah, I was reading that Armando Garcia, the infamous former executive director of the California State Athletic Commission, said, "No, you can't do it in a ring."
Yeah, and because of that, in the last minute, they had to go get Donald Cerrone to drive it all the way across country.
Yeah, so you sent Donald Cerrone to Tennessee. Is that the story?
I guess that's the truth. That no one knew though later that it was Donald Cerrone was the guy driving the truck over the mountains, stuck in the blizzard,
yeah,
helping deliver a cage.
How did they know? I mean, did Cerrone go there with the guy that started Ring of Fire?
Yeah, Sean. No, well, he ordered it, Bean.
Yeah, Seb, right?
I mean, he ordered it. He didn't go with him, but he's got orders. But he sent Cerrone and another guy to go pick it up, I guess.
Only in MMA. So the cage shows up, like, I think Coker said, like, 3 or 4 in the morning or something?
Yeah, it showed up the morning before the show, and, like, everybody, literally everybody that's the Bay Area manager, trainer, whatever, was working on the cage. put it together. And thankfully, you know, some of them had construction history, and they were able to put it together. I mean, you miss stuff like that. Just how spit and gum MMA was back in the early days.
Yeah. So, what was the team there at Strikeforce? Of course, you had Coker. You had Mike Aframowicz doing communications, PR. Who else were the decision makers at that point? You know, at the genesis of Strikeforce as a MMA promotion.
I guess Ken Elner was a business advisor to Scott from the earliest. In the early days, they had Bob Cook doing some matchmaking, advising matchmaking with them. And that was probably the nucleus. They had a very small staff. I guess Kerry Ayanna, Scott's longtime assistant, was there.
Sure.
A couple other people are just, I'm drawing a blank on, but there was, you know, it was a very, like, a 7-man staff in the very beginning.
Was Rich Chow involved at that point?
No, he was with... He was in Hawaii at the time, and then he went to Elite XC, and then he got picked up from Scott after Elite.
Oh, okay.
But he worked with them over in some shows before that. He knew him before, but yeah, it was after Elite went down that they picked up Rich Chow.
Right. So early 2007, there were some talks between Scott Coker and Saki Kibara, the former president, Dream Stage Entertainment, the parent company of Pride, to acquire Pride, Strikeforce possibly looking into acquiring Pride. Of course, it didn't happen, and I guess there just wasn't enough time to get a deal done, or what, or was it a money thing?
I think the big thing didn't happen is because they already were striking a deal with the UFC, and the UFC met their terms right away, and, you know, and Scott and his guys were hesitant.
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, one of the biggest stories in MMA history. And, you know, I can remember they bought it, you know, thinking they were going to continue to run Pride. And they sent, I forget the fellow's name, they sent a guy over there, an executive. I don't know if it was Jamie Pollock, but it might have been. And he went over there for a few months and, you know, they opened up a little office. And then they were like, well, shit, this ain't going to work. And they got the hell out of there.
the guys there were the basically an open revolt almost right away, setting up their own promotion in the background on the UFC's dime.
Yeah, that didn't, and it didn't last too long. What they do? One show, Yarinoka? Remember Yarinoka? Or is that how you say
it? They actually didn't even do that show. That was the last show. I think that wasn't that Pride themselves ran into that. The end. UFC had nothing to do with that though. That was K1 and the FIG guys doing it themselves. That was their new launch.
So when Fedor fought Hongman Choi, that I thought that was the Dream Stage guys.
Yeah, it was Dream Stage, the guys that abandoned the UFC and teaming up with the guys that own K1.
Gotcha. So, I mean, how did you?
I might be mistaken. Might have just been. You're right. It might be just the Dream Stage guys.
Yeah. The thing about Japan is it's so confusing because like these guys are kind of in cahoots, and it's just like in professional wrestling. There, like you think these guys are rival promotions, and it's like. It's like the same guy controlling multiple promotions.
Oh yeah, it is professional wrestling in Japan.
Well, you're right. That's what
it's
it
straight is. Professional. It's professional wrestling for real. That's the part I think a lot of fans miss here in the U.S. They don't quite, you know. I had no clue when I first started watching Pride that it was professional. I just thought it was really wacky.
Are you a pro wrestling guy?
I haven't watched it. I mean, I write a lot about it, but I haven't actually watched pro wrestling in like 25 years.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by the industry.
Yeah, I mean, me too. I mean, I kind of joke about it, and you know, I make it out to be I watch a lot more of it than I do. But yeah, I've been fascinated with the industry, I guess, since I was 8 years old. I'm in my early 30s now, and it's amazing how much it is MMA. You know, it's just what it is. MMA is a form of pro wrestling.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated by the history of pro and MMA, how they coincide. They actually come from the same source. It's their pro wrestling is MMA and pro wrestling both existed, you know, in the early 20th century, and pro wrestling is the fake version of it, and MMA is the real version that lasted.
Yeah, and you're right, and that's the reason why I reached out to you, because I'm really interested in the history of MMA, and it's kind of, we're kind of in this new sport, right? That, you know, we're talking about 2006, 2007, and we're talking it like it's the old days, and it is, you know, because there's so much that's happened since then in the short amount of time that it's really fascinating to me to kind of just take a look back.
Yeah, it's you don't think about it, but then you just sit back and you know you just sit and go, wow, it's. I mean, there used to be fighters all over. Just different promotions every month if you hold an event. There's Affliction, there's IFL, there's Elite XC, and they just came and gone.
So, you know, Strikeforce, and Coker always points out, Strikeforce, when it started out, was primarily, or 100%, a live event promotion, meaning they didn't syndicate the broadcast. They really didn't have any sponsors. I mean, I think Aframowitz was trying to get some. But it was just completely based around the live gate. But that all changed when Elite XC went belly up and Coker was able to move in and buy some selected assets from Pro Elite, Elite XC, whatever you want to call it. So what do you remember from the acquisition of those assets, Coker from Elite XC?
I just remember that I remember just in the paper at the time, a lot of the managers were fighting it. Remember that? There was a big movement by about a bunch of managers teamed up to sue it.
I think Ken Pavia was involved.
Ken Pavia, Ed Soares, I think Bob Cook, I think Bob Cook, it could be Caesar Gracie.
But I mean, they had, I could see why they were upset. They were holding these guys hostage, right?
Oh, yeah. You had no clue when they're going to fight again, you know, who they're going to fight for, because the deal hadn't been struck yet. But, the big move, obviously, the assets were important because he gained a bunch of, you know, potential stars like Robbie Lawler and Jake Shields and Gina Carano, and Nick Diaz. But the big thing was just getting the Showtime deal and, you know, reworking the Showtime deal that it was not quite as, it was much more lucrative for Strikeforce, a much better deal for Strikeforce than it was for Elite XC, that's for sure.
Yeah, that was such a messed up launch for Pro Elite. I mean, of course, there were so many things wrong with that company. They spent like $5 million on a friggin' website that nobody went to. They were spending some ungodly amount of money per month in office space rent.
Yeah, they had a huge office building. They spent, I think, 20-some million on acquiring promotions that, you know, that didn't even really have fighters that were worth having, or, you know, I mean, did they really have to buy Cage Warriors in UK? Do they need, you know?
How about the one in Korea?
Yeah, they invest in Korea. It's like 20, I mean, they were in the hole for just the, if you think just about that website and the promotions, that's 30-some million dollars they blew through without even holding an event. And then on top of that, their first year, whatever, they're holding events that they had to pay for the production for Showtime, and they weren't even getting any money from Showtime?
Yeah, they weren't getting a rights fee, which, you know, like you alluded to earlier there, this was a game changer for Strikeforce because they were getting a license fee, which for some people, if you don't know what that is, it's just a set amount of money a TV station will pay you to put on the show, and typically they'll pick up the production too. All the things that goes into making the event, even the PR, and you know they'll have Showtime has their own PR people. So how is it? Do you have figures? I mean, I really only saw one license fee disclosed, and that was in the state of Florida because that was something that the commission used to do, and it was about I think it was $700,000 for Herschel Walker.
From my understanding and talking to people, and you know, I don't know how 100% accurate this is, but it seems pretty good. Is it started out about $500,000 a year, and then every year it bumped up 250. So you know, first year was $500,000. The second year when they did the Florida show was 750. Third year would have been $1 million. Fourth year would have been 1.25, and I don't know if it went up beyond that. But that was, and then you know, minus some, maybe some production costs or whatever or marketing that they had to take out for Showtime. That's where you got the $700,000.
Yeah, so for people that don't know, that's basically the boxing model where these premium TV stations will pay a set fee to a promoter to run the show. And so that's what Scott Coker and company kind of got into and really took them to the next level, gave them the ability to start assembling a roster of some very well-known fighters and fighters that didn't come cheap at all.
Yeah, they paid, you know, they had to pay pretty good just to compete with the UFC. So they, but they definitely had higher, and they paid decent purses. If you're on the main card of a Strikeforce card, you probably were making pretty good money.
Yeah, I remember looking at some of those purses. Like even a guy like Josh Thompson back then was making $80,000 or $90,000 a fight. Robbie Lawler was making a ton of money. You know, even back then. He wasn't fighting too well. I think he had lost like 3 out of 4 or something.
Yeah, he was about 500 in Strikeforce. But, of course, he was fighting at middleweight, fighting, you know, in hindsight, you look back at the guys he lost to, like Tim Kennedy and stuff, you realize that he, you know, he was fighting probably at a higher weight class than he should against much stronger competition, I think, than we realized at the time.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. You know, how he's been able to recreate his career. And what's even more amazing is he's 32 years old. He's been around forever.
Yeah, it's just his run is pretty damn incredible, I guess. That's the only way to put it. He's turned it around. But I don't think, I mean, in hindsight, again, I don't know if he turned it around. I think he moved into the right weight class. I mean, in a weird way, taking on guys who, in hindsight, we now realize are killers at a higher weight class. He was always better than I think people assumed.
Yeah, I had somebody tell me, like, one of his things, like, he moved to Arizona, and he developed some kind of, like, asthma issue. And, you know, you would think the desert, that's supposed to help your asthma. Well, this messed with his breathing. And I know it sounds totally far-fetched. So he gets out of Arizona. He was training down there. And then he goes to Florida. And then he feels like so much better, like he can actually breathe while he's out there. And he, you know, he goes down to 170 and starts to build his career back.
I haven't heard that. That's maybe I'll have to ask a doctor about bacteria in the desert.
Yeah, I heard about. I mean, I had heard, you know, because I always thought, oh, desert, you know, that's because I have allergies. That's great. And then I've had my allergist say, well, not always. I mean, there's a possibility it could help you, but it's not a for sure thing. But, you know, just to get the train back on the tracks here a little bit, the next major thing for Strikeforce was bringing in Fedor. You know, he had had the well-documented breakdown in negotiations with the UFC. And the way that it's stated in your article, Scott basically took the meeting with Vadim and who is that? Steve Bash, right? Is the lawyer, the LA lawyer?
Yeah, I get, yeah.
For M1. And he basically went in there and said, well, you know, you guys are going to get a good deal from the UFC. So he almost went into it like not expecting much.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he assumed that they'd be signing with the UFC, but that the UFC negotiations, you know, fell apart because they wouldn't agree to co-branding, and Scott picked it up. You know, I can't, I mean, it was just, it's one of those things, I think, that both the UFC and I think M1, I mean, people get upset at both promotions or both sides, but both have a strong reason for doing what they wanted to do, and both couldn't come to terms.
Yeah, and you also make mention of Affliction 3, when Barnett flunked his drug test and wasn't able to get a license. So Coker calls up Todd Beard, who was a former executive at Affliction, who passed away maybe about 6 months ago. Very young. I think he was maybe in his early 40s or something. Not exactly sure the circumstances surrounding his death. But Coker called up Beard and asked him for Brett Rogers.
Yeah, that's – or you mean Beard called up Coker and asked for Brett Rogers.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I got totally – yeah, totally backwards. So Beard calls him up. He wants to save his show. And
he tried to get Brett Rogers, and Coker turned it – you know, him and his partners turned it down, and then they were rethinking it, I guess, but they've already canceled the fight by the time.
Yeah, I mean, I was supposed to go to that show. And
I was too. I was going to go.
Yeah. I think there was three rumors. Okay, so Fedor versus Rogers, Fedor versus Vitor,
yep,
which supposedly M1 did not want. They thought Vitor was maybe too quick for Fedor and would cause problems, I guess, in the stand-up.
I heard they talked about having Fedor versus Belfort before, but their problem, from what I heard, I don't know if he was too quick. I heard their problem was that they were worried about the criticism Fedor would get for taking out a guy that just fought at middleweight.
Yeah, they're probably, yeah, and Dana would have been the first guy, you know, saying.
I think the plan for a long time was to get, you know, get Belfort. If they're ever going to put him against Fedor, I think there's some negotiations, I think, in January that year to get Belfort to resign, and the idea was to have Belfort fight at middleweight whenever middleweight belt there, move him up a weight class and move him up again, almost like the plan they were, Strikeforce tried to do with Dan Henderson, but
yeah,
have Belfort keep moving up and then put him against Fedor.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, Henderson, it was also in your article, Henderson was, at one point, they were thinking about putting him in the heavyweight Grand Prix.
Yeah, that's, you know, that was a talk. I think the part of the plan, too, is with Henderson, or just the thought or thinking. I don't know if they, you know, when they say this stuff, I don't know if they think that far ahead sometimes, but is if he won the middleweight, put him in the light heavyweight, if he wins the light heavyweight belt, okay, then put him against Fedor.
Yeah, and then just to finish it, the last rumor when Fedor at Affliction 3, it was Bobby Lashley, which seemed totally ridiculous.
In retrospect,
still ridiculous.
I've heard about that too, and I don't know. There's also some talk of Alistair Overeem, I guess, but I don't know how serious that was. Is that just with a name thrown out there or not?
I got to think that was just a name thrown out because to hotshot that promotion, because that. So we're talking summer 2009. Overeem was a big deal in 2009.
The other thing I heard too is they were really kicking themselves that they let out that Arlovsky fight Rogers before, because if they would have kept him around for the show, they would have had a backup plan, a rematch.
You know, from what I remember about that, Arlovsky had some clause in his contract that all four of the fights that they owed him had to be done in 12 months or else they voided the contract.
Yeah, that's obviously true. I don't know about that.
Yeah, there was something really like, so he fought Rothwell, then Roy Nelson in Elite XC, then he fought Fedor, and then he fought Brett Rogers in Strikeforce, and I think that was in June, and yeah, they were up against the clock on with his contract. And in that 12-month period, he banked $3 million.
Yeah, he made pretty good money. You know,
yeah,
it was probably a wise, even losing the two fights out of that four, that was probably a wise decision. signed that contract.
Oh, big time. Yeah. So, I mean, it took him a while to get back to the UFC. And in fact, he's fighting this weekend against Travis Brown, which is a pretty interesting fight.
Yeah, I'm favoring Brown heavily on that fight, but you never know.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, Fedor signs with Strikeforce. They go on CBS. What do you, because it's one of those things that's been talked about so much amongst fans on the internet, that all the finances behind M1, and I guess people kind of have an idea. Some of the information came out with the Affliction lawsuit. M1 went after Affliction, and it looked like Fedor was getting a $300,000 disclosed salary, and M1 was getting a $1.2 or a $1.5 million consulting agreement for bringing Fedor to the venue.
That's almost exactly it. It was $300,000 for Fedor, $1.2 million for Affliction. Fedor's contract, though, got leaked too, and his contract was $2 million a fight back then, which Affliction was paying $1.5 million, and M1 had to come up with the other $500,000 themselves. And so, in fact, the interesting thing about that Affliction lawsuit is Fedor was getting paid by Affliction $1.5 million only until a few weeks before the fight. Then they switched it to $300,000. It was obviously trying to hide the taxes that they owed.
Yeah, because you know, if you're not a citizen of the United States, they'll take 30%. They'll withhold 30% right off the top, which is actually what happened. Like Manny Pacquiao, I think he got a check. I don't know the exact amount from Bob Arum, but he takes 30%. That's not a top rank thing. That's the United States government. That I guess they're afraid that the foreign athletes are going to come in here, make their money, and not pay their taxes.
Yeah, that's I guess that's completely it. But that's everybody. You always see these foreign fighters making like $500, and you're like, wait a minute, how can that guy be paid so little? Because
but you
paying about someone else to pay him in his home country. That way, he doesn't have to pay as much on the local taxes.
Yeah. Like, do you remember what was it? Pride 32, or what was that? In the two in Vegas, they had one in late 2006, and then they had one in February 2007 when Hendo knocked out Vanderlei Silva, and like I think Shogun made $10,000 with no win bonus. So it's just like, oh, come on, guys, you gotta make it. If that doesn't raise a gigantic red flag, then I don't know what will.
If I remember right, the Coleman Fader one, it was like everybody on the card was making the same amount for almost everybody, $10,000 a fight.
Yeah, it was just total bullshit. And Fedor might have been on the card. He might have been for $50,000, but I don't know. It could have been $10,000. But so your understanding of Fedor's deal with Strikeforce, how was that structured?
I don't know all the details. From what I understand from some people, it was very similar to the Affliction. It was almost the same amount. All the talk of the co-promotion stuff that M1 got 50%, that doesn't seem true at all. It was, you know, that they were paying M1 a large sum of money for Fedor, and then they were giving M1 the rights to Russian television, complete rights there, library, and co-branding, so M1 could claim that they're the co-promoter of all Fedor's events.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds plausible to me. I mean, I can't believe Scott would have gotten into a deal where 50% of the revenue would be going to a promoter who's, you know, the only thing they were doing was bringing Fedor. I mean, that's what it was, co-promotion, but it was like, well, what exactly are you doing other than, like, I'll give you an example. 2011, I was in Chicago for Fedor versus Dan Henderson. I stop in the bar before heading over to the arena, and Vadim is in there enjoying some drinks, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, that's kind of a relaxing day for someone who's promoting an event with 15,000 people right down the street.
Yeah, he doesn't have much work to do, so which is good. It's a turnkey operation when he brings Fedor.
Yeah, he literally just makes sure he shows up, and you know, that was quite a deal. I don't know if anyone will ever get that type of deal from a promotion.
Yeah, I mean, I think Fedor was trying to, you know, I mean, it didn't work, but I think he was trying to do more of a boxing type deal. You know, I think that was a big thing too with the UFC. People forget is he did not want to have, at least his one thing people forget, he was already signed to M1. They weren't just going to sign Fedor. M1 had to agree to it. They already, you know, they already signed Fedor. That was their asset.
I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand, and nobody really, at least that from my recollection, nobody really spelled that out, that, you know, it wasn't Fedor coming to the table talking to Dana and Lorenzo. It was like Fedor signed away his rights, and he's being, you know, he got like a couple $1 million signing bonus. Remember that Sibling Entertainment thing with Monty Cox? And
yeah.
So as part of that deal, N1 cut him a big check, you know, probably a couple $1 million bonus. And for that, they were allowed to go out and sell his services.
Yeah, that was the deal, that Fedor got this deal, this long-term contract, not long, but 4 to 6 fight contract, mattered which time he signed it, and he got 8% of the company, M1, and so, you know, I think he said once if they had gave him the offer in 2007 that they gave him later, he never would have signed the M1 deal, M1 Global deal. He would have signed with the UFC, but it was too late. You know, when the UFC made that offer, and I don't know how big of an offer it really was, it could be a monster offer, but it wasn't only up to Fedor to decide that deal at that time.
Yeah, I remember there's a guy up in Sacramento, Carmichael Dave.
Yeah.
Is that he's a radio personality?
Yeah.
So from what I remember, Dana leaked some numbers to him. And, you know, I don't know if he was just being kind of I'm not saying he's an idiot, but being used as a useful idiot just to kind of repeat what he said. I don't know. But it was some ridiculous contract, like $30 million over 6 fights.
Yeah, that's so. I remember the one getting leaked, and I remember Jonathan Snowden talked to M1 people, and that was nothing like the actual contract.
Yeah, I just can't believe that if they were willing to pay him $5 to $6 million a fight, why wouldn't M1 say, okay, forget the co-promotion, we'll just take the money and use all the profit
sure, we'll to keep $3 million a fight.
Yeah, we'll just take the difference, right?
Yeah, I don't think that's of course, again, there was a big money guy, I can't remember the guy's name, the Russian that was financing everything back then. Maybe he thought M1 was going to take off and be the UFC of, you know, of Europe.
Well, the money guy, there was the mayor of St. Petersburg, it was a woman, I think Vadienko or something like that, and she had a son. Vitaly.
Russian name, so I'm not going to guess it.
Yeah, Vitaly Vadienko or something like that, and he was the money behind this thing. So, you know, and I think that's how M1 kind of got real close to Putin, because they had this political ally that this woman, this guy's mom, was was the mayor of the second biggest city in the country.
Yeah, I mean, it was a good. I guess he's no longer involved with the M1, but that was the guy for a while pulling the strings, or I guess financing the show in St. Petersburg, financing shows in London. You know that although that Bodog show in St. Petersburg, I heard, was just a disaster. They really blew that because they had all the opportunity in the world to introduce to the Russian audience, and they didn't do it.
Yeah, and I mean, I've heard some just ridiculously bad pay-per-view numbers on that one. They paid Matt Lindland a ton of money too for that.
Oh yeah, I guess that's a lesson people should learn: is you just can't put on a pay per view and expect it to sell. You need some sort of TV push behind it as well.
And that's something they would have known if they would have read the Wrestling Observer newsletter. I mean, that's something that Dave Meltzer, like, you can't sell a pay per view without steady TV. That's why Affliction failed.
Yeah.
That's just wrestling 101.
Yeah, I mean, in hindsight, I mean, you look back at Affliction, and you're like, you guys would have been better off signing a deal with Showtime, spreading your fighters over for a year, and then doing a pay-per-view.
Or get one of these private equity companies to throw $300 or $400 million at you like they're doing to Al Haymon.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess Al Haymon, yeah, that's, I don't know if anybody was willing to do that with MMA back then.
Yeah, yeah, the Haymon deal is, it's
fascinating.
Yeah, and I know you've been covering that too. And it's, from what I understand, it just seems it's just a straight time buy, and they're trying to, I guess after 2 or 3 years, try to sell the rights, and, you know, because sports TV rights are just through the roof. You know, the NBA, the last deal they did, which is going to increase the salary cap, I'm probably just making this up, from like $67 million to like $85 million or something like that.
yeah, it's just going to keep skyrocketing after that too. The deal's astronomical. That
So is that the payoff for Heyman to sell this huge TV package to these various broadcasters?
From several people I've heard that are in the business, that know the business well, they think that's the plan. They think it's very simple. It's that he wants control over the product, because if he was on one channel and he did bad ratings, it would lower the asking price in the future. But if he does time buys and he controls the product, he can wait and build up the ratings. And then down the line, he comes back and says, okay, one channel wants the exclusive rights to PBC boxing. It's going to be $200 million a year. And that'll pay for it, because right now Showtime and HBO's budget for boxing and ESPN altogether last year was under $100 million.
Yeah, I like the concept that it's on CBS. I was in L.A. last weekend for Metamorphosis. I was in Manhattan Beach at some restaurant, and I just asked them, hey, can you put on CBS? And they're like, yeah, no problem. And the boxing match was right on there. Before it's like, what places show premium cable?
Yeah, I love it that it's on TV. I mean, I don't know if it's going to last. I don't know if he's going to be successful in his effort with all the money they're throwing in. And I don't know if the Attorney General is going to put a stop to his plans, but for now I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, well, so he's getting sued by Oscar De La Hoya.
Yeah, he's getting sued by Oscar De La Hoya, and on behalf of the ABC, sent a letter to the Attorney General asking that he be investigated for violating federal law, the Muhammad Ali Reform Boxing Act. So he's got UFC's got their problems. Al Heyman's PBC's got a lot of his own problems.
Yeah, but at least the UFC's made some money. I mean, Heyman, his payouts, for his inaugural or kickoff event, I think the payout was $4 million.
Yeah, $5 million actually. Everybody, including the undercard, because they have Abner on the undercard. Mara's making $450,500.
Yeah, it's nothing for him to put a guy out there, two guys out there making seven figures.
Because Heyman ain't losing money, because as an advisor, he gets 15% of all that.
He's
some people actually think that's the plan, that he got some money marks to put up a ton of money, pay huge purses, and at the back end, he'll collect 15%.
Yeah, he's pulling the Monty Cox.
Yeah, so it's Monty's a little different.
He doesn't make that much. Yeah.
Doesn't make that much, and his is not a violation of the Ali Act when he used to do it, because being a manager and a promoter, because he wasn't doing sanctioned title fights, and all of his guys, I think on all the shows, only have one contracts with his promotion.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's a little bit. When you're doing low end, it's a little different. You're allowed to do it under the Muhammad Ali Act. Be a promoter and a manager when you're doing the local shows. It's when you get to the national.
So if it's a national television, then the Ali Act kicks in?
Well, the Ali Act actually kicks in when you're doing 10-round or 12-round fights, which are the sanctioned bodied fights. So if you're fighting for the WBO title, or you're in a contenders match for the WBO title, then you can't be a promoter and a manager for a fight like that. But if you're doing a 4-round local show, you can do both.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. And just to get back, the last thing with Strikeforce, so we can wrap it up here, is the acquisition, the sale, if you will. And there's been a lot of talk. I think maybe one of the first times that I interacted with you, I was completely under the impression they were hemorrhaging money. And Silicon Valley Sports and Entertainment said, hey guys, we put enough money into this, and we don't want to get in an arms race with the UFC. They got more money than us. They have more experience. They have better talent. And we can't get any more into this than we already are. We gotta get out of it. And
that seems to be the common wisdom, the common thought, that they were hemorrhaging money. I think part of it's because everybody else hemorrhaged money and lost. And it's like, well, IFL hemorrhaged money and lost, Affliction did, Elite XC, what's the difference? Strikeforce must have done the same thing.
So what is your take on it? If somebody asks you what happened?
Well, just asking around and stuff, I would say part of it is, the ownership, Silicon Valley, wanted to get out of it, but they got out of everything that's not hockey-related at that time. They got out of, they had an apparel company they sold. They sold ice rinks. They sold their tennis. They owned a bunch of tennis tournaments. They got rid of those, and they got rid of Strikeforce. And I think what happened is, I mean, I don't know, I'm not in the room, but from several different sources, the UFC contacted Strikeforce, made an offer to buy, upped the offer to buy, and, you know, they said, well, we put this much money in and we're going to make, you know, let's, I'm just going to throw a number out, two or three times as much as what we put in right now. Why take the risk? Because there's still a risk going forward. They have to pay large. What if we sign a lot of fighters for a lot of money and we lose our Showtime deal? Or we have to put them on pay-per-view and our pay-per-view is bomb and we have to pay these guys out. So they decide, why take any future risk? Let's take the money in their hand now and quit. But from every source I had, they were a viable company. They weren't planning on shutting the doors. They weren't on a fire sale. They had to get rid of the company. They were going to keep going.
And things were on the upswing. I mean, I was at the last show before they sold. It was the heavyweight Grand Prix in New Jersey, and I think they did 12,000 paid and at very high ticket prices. I think it might have been scaled to $500 a ticket.
Yeah, I think it did pretty good. I mean, it did over $1 million gate. I mean, it wasn't official, never came out, but that's what I heard. It was an over $1 million gate.
Yeah, and it did excellent ratings.
Yeah, the highest ever MMA on Showtime.
Yeah, so I mean, I left New Jersey that weekend, you know, because I had really embraced the Strikeforce product. I really liked it. And I thought they got something here. You know, the UFC is still number one, probably always be number one, but we got a really strong number two brand here. And then a month later, they sell to the UFC, and it was kind of like, I think to a lot of people, kind of like a kick in the gut to all the hardcore fans that had supported Strikeforce.
Yeah, I know a lot of people just thought it was April Fool's when it was announced. Because, you know, they're doing so well on their numbers the last three shows before they sold. But yeah, I mean, I don't want to make it like they were making a ton of money, because from what I understand, they had debt. The owners put in, I don't think it was actual debt in the sense like a bank loan, but the owners put in a certain capital, and they were making a little bit of money, you know. But you know, just look at it from their point of view. If you're making at that point $1 million or $2 million in profit a year, and you have a plan in the future, you think you might make a lot of money, but you're making $1 million or $2 million right then, and someone comes by and says, here's $30-35 million, you don't have to take that risk. You know, and you're an investment, you're a capital venture guy. Do you take that money now, the money that's offered right now, or do you roll the dice?
Yeah. And, you know, I know Coker kind of plays it like, you know, he really didn't want to sell it, but I mean, I heard this was quite a payout for him.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure he didn't want to sell. And I know other guys that were part of it that thought it was a mistake and they thought they should hang on. And I'm sure I know a lot of people involved when the Spike deal opening came up, I'm sure all of them were kicking themselves because they knew they could have made a lot more money, you know, just on that sale.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Their price would have doubled right then.
Yeah, they would have been on Showtime and then could have been on Spike also.
Well, I mean, the UFC still might have bought them, but their asking price would have been so much higher that there's, you know, that there's several avenues for them to be broadcast on, several interested parties. But I've talked to Spike and I've talked to Showtime, and they had no clue they were for sale. So that's right. So I'm guessing there was some sort of non-disclosure agreement when they went into negotiations.
Now, who else was in? I mean, I had heard Shelley Finkel was in discussions. There was somebody.
There's some other parties, but I don't think there was ever that serious. And like I said, the people that would have probably spent the most, have the most interest, and have the most money, Showtime or Spike, apparently had no knowledge that that Strikeforce was being sold.
Wow.
So
yeah,
the other ones, Elite XC didn't really have much, or Pro Elite didn't really have much capital to put into it that was supposedly interested.
Yeah. I guess they're technically still alive. Are they?
Yeah, I don't know what they're doing. They're just, I'm sure their stocks is very affordable right now.
Yeah. Oh, man. I remember that first show. Did they have Arlovsky on that thing?
Their comeback one?
The comeback one, yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact show it was. Yeah, they did. They got Arlovsky, and I don't know if they've done anything since. Honestly, I'm drawing a blank.
Yeah, they might have done maybe one other show. I guess we're talking, what, 2012 or something? And
after it was after Strike Force done in 2000, about 2000, end of 2011 or 2012, somewhere in there.
Yeah, it's tough to get these. I mean, if you don't have TV, if you don't have somebody, you know, giving you those rights fees, it's really difficult to survive. Which is, how the hell is World Series of Fighting keeping their doors open?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if they got, you know, what their revenue sources are. From everything I've seen, they don't seem to have much. But who knows? Maybe they're making a lot overseas. Maybe they have a really good sales staff that's just cranking in overseas sales.
Or the conspiracy that UFC is keeping them alive.
Yeah, I've heard that conspiracy. I mean, you know, like everything, I check into every conspiracy, but, you know, I've heard it, no evidence of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, I'd be surprised if UFC was, you know, keeping it, doing anything with it right now. I just can't imagine them taking the risk.
Yeah, because, I mean, I guess the conspiracy is, oh, it'll help them with antitrust, you know, that there's competition out there. And, you know, I'm like, well, you know, but there's Bellator. That's competition.
That would have been the conspiracy. There's two conspiracies. One, they're keeping them alive, and the other conspiracy is the UFC helped them found them. And that'd be the other conspiracy for the antitrust.
Yeah.
But who knows? Now we're just, you know, throwing stuff in the – we're taking guesses.
Yeah. All right, John. Hey, so that's kind of our trip down – memory lane about Strikeforce, which is
one thing we missed, and I should add in my article, and I didn't include, was when, I don't know if you remember, when Frank Shamrock challenged Dana White to fight Scott Coker for the right to Frank Shamrock in the UFC?
Wait, when did he do this?
He did that in, what, late 2006 or 2007?
Oh, really?
But it issued out to must have been 2000, yeah, it was late 2006. It was before Chuck Liddell lost Rampage, I believe, and he issued a challenge to Dana White. You have to, if you come and fight Scott Coker, and if you beat him, I'll come to UFC and I'll fight Chuck Liddell for free. If Scott Coker wins, you got to send us Chuck Liddell.
I like that. I think that was Frank doing his pro wrestling gimmick.
Yeah, that was when he was at his best. I mean, if you his old videos, he actually was really good at that stuff back then.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the build up to Phil Baroni when he fought Baroni.
Yeah, actually, that was a great performance. I mean, you know, the fight was even great when he did the going putting you to sleep sign in the middle of the fight. That was, you know, that's like, this guy's a star. Unfortunately, he didn't have the Showtime deal at the time, and
yeah,
didn't market him as much. But at the time, you're like, wow, this, you know, Frank Shamrock's got the charisma you need to be a star in this sport.
Yeah, that was a good fight, but it was such a disaster. I mean, Frank had a torn ACL, right? Baroni,
yeah, he had some injury, and I guess for, you know, but that turned out to be great for Strikeforce because he was still under contract with them when he was with Elite XC, and because of that, Showtime started working with Strikeforce for the Kung Lee fight, and they started thinking, I guess they started going, hey, the Strikeforce guys seem to have their act a lot more together than the Elite XC guys.
So what is Frank doing now? He's doing something with Bellator?
I'm not sure what he does with Bellator. I know he lives out here in California and he does some acting.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't really heard much. I know he's like, his best friend is Mickey Rourke.
Yeah, he gets along good with Mickey. I'll have to give him a call. I have a soft spot for Frank. Like I said, he's the guy that kind of introduced me into liking MMA, so...
Yeah. All right, John. Hey, really interesting conversation. Hope you know, people found it somewhat interesting. We talked a little bit.
I hope
bit.
I didn't bore the shit out of them.
No. I thought it was interesting to me. So if it's not interesting to them, then forget them. But, you know, we talked a little bit about the lawsuit, talked about, you know, not all of the, but a lot of the major events that transpired in Strikeforce and some of the stories behind them. And of course, I'll put out on my Twitter. I'll put out the links to the secret history of Strikeforce, which was on bloodyelbow.com, and really, really an interesting 5 article series. That I don't know what the market is for it, but it looks like it's got the beginnings of a good book. You know, I don't know what MMA books. I don't know if they sell anymore.
I'm not sure there's that big of audience for to expand that, but you know, if people are interested, I might do. I have some stuff I didn't include because I cut it short. I couldn't find a quite chapter. Maybe I'll do a bonus one. or I'll include all the little stories like the Frank Shamrock challenging Dana White to fight Scott Coker. There's a few other little stories like that that didn't make the series, actually.
Yeah, and there was that brings up one. There was one other thing. Paul Heyman was mentioned.
Yes.
And it wasn't going to be anything special. It was going to be like just use him to do some like advertising consulting or.
Yeah, that was it. I mean, I remember the rumors that Paul Heyman was going to be involved in Strikeforce, and everybody thought he'd be the face and the spokesperson and all that.
Yeah.
And really it was just his to go with his marketing plan to help him do the marketing.
Now, how about Shane McMahon?
With Strikeforce?
Yeah.
I didn't hear much of anything about Shane McMahon.
Okay.
Involved in Strikeforce. I mean, maybe he was interested in buying at one point, but I didn't hear that from anybody.
Yeah. I mean, I know he meant with...
You know, he was interested in getting MMA for a while.
Yeah. Nothing ever became of that. I mean, I know he had a meeting with Dana White. I don't know what it was about. I don't know if he tried to buy a portion of the UFC or, you know, he just. I wish he'd get involved in something because his name has so much value.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people that have expressed interest in getting involved in MMA, but I think when they look at it after a while, it's like if you're not the UFC, it's almost impossible to make money at this.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things. Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, look at the guy, Ed Fishman, who was going to buy Pride.
Yeah, he was, it'd be interesting what would have happened if he got a hold of Pride.
I think he started to figure out, like, what he was buying. It was, like, you know, really dirty, you know, Yakuza infested. And
yeah, it was just a shell of a company. I mean, the only people that could profit from Pride, really, were the UFC because they already had the UFC. So they could blow that money. Just basically take possession of Pride and whatever few contracts they get a hold of, but because you always had the UFC to, you know, to take whatever assets are left and put them in the UFC. Anybody else buying Pride, you're buying an abandoned house.
Yeah, and it turned out a lot of those contracts were not enforceable.
Yeah, so it was a
the UFC.
It was a interesting time. I mean, it's like I said, it's funny that there's Ed Fishman and Scott Coker and all were involved and interested and. I mean, the Pride guys were smart. They had three potential buyers lined up and said, hey, whoever wants to buy us, you can't look at our books.
Yeah. And they also did a good job of hyping up that Vince McMahon was interested.
Yeah,
I remember on WWE.com one time, they're like, oh, Saki Kabara visits WWE headquarters. And yeah. You could just kind of tell. It was like they're a publicly traded company. They're not going to buy this mess of a company in Japan. And you could just tell they were just trying to, you know, run the value up of it.
I find interesting, like, an alternate reality is, alternate history is, what would have happened if Spike, who were thinking about at the time, put Pride on after the WWE shows instead of UFC? In 2004, I guess, David Diamond, the guy at the time was looking for content, wanted to put Pride on.
Well, my opinion is that whoever would have come on after Monday Night Raw was going to become the big company. And, you know, people say Dana's a genius. Well, number one, he didn't even want to do The Ultimate Fighter. He didn't want to do reality shows, right? So, I mean, to me, the guy that made the UFC is Vince McMahon because from all sources, he had veto power to get them for them not to be on after Raw. And he said, fine, let them be on.
Yeah, well, I give them credit. I mean, they were definitely shopping. They knew they had to get on TV, and they're doing everything they could to get on TV and get a reality show. But I just wonder if Pride would have taken off just as well because it was so pro wrestling that would the pro wrestling audience have eaten that up? Like, oh my God, there's pro wrestling, but for real from Japan.
Yeah, it really would have been interesting. I who the hell knows? But
yeah, it's one of those things you'll never know. I mean. I will give Dana White credit on one thing. I guess supposedly no one else wanted to sign Brock Lesnar, and he's the guy that said, oh, we got to get him.
Yeah.
That's true, but that's what I heard. I go, he's the guy that made that call. He just earned his paycheck.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, but, you know, to me it was kind of like a no-brainer. It's like, yeah, throw him in the cage. I mean, from what I remember, Brock kind of had to talk him into it.
Yeah, he was talking to the UFC, but, I guess at the time they were, like, worried about, oh, we don't want to be too tarnished with the pro wrestling label. He has no track record. It's going to make us look, you know. Because at that time, they were still really worried. Remember, they're always marketing them as real as it gets. They were worried about being too much tarnished with pro wrestling. They had to make people know this is real.
Yeah. I remember this was back when Brock talked to people, you know, before he became a big deal. Like, he would actually do interviews and stuff and actually communicate to people. And they asked, you know, I forget which event. I think it was at UFC 74 when Randy fought Gabriel Gonzaga. And they asked him, well, Brock, what are you doing out here? And he said, I'm looking for a job.
I remember that, yeah.
You know, and it was like, Brock's actually in a good mood.
That's the one thing I'd like to add to the Strikeforce series, is get an interview with Paul Heyman to see how serious supposedly his plan was. And, you know, other people deny that he ever was going to buy Strikeforce. But according to him, according to his plan was to, you know, buy Strikeforce or buy into it and get Brock to be their future star, bring him to Strikeforce.
I don't think it would have ended well. You don't want Heyman, you don't want him calling the shots when there's money involved. You kind of want him out there to just do his little, you know, do his gimmick, get people riled up. But, you know, I don't think the guy can balance a checkbook.
Well, I guess when someone else is paying for it, I guess that's not a problem.
Yeah. Well, you know, hey, been enjoyable talking to you, John. I'll let you go, man. But,
okay,
hey, thanks for, you know, sharing your insights into Strikeforce. You obviously have a lot of sources, you know, from the people that made Strikeforce what it was. And, yeah, it's kind of sad that it's not there no more, but definitely still fun to talk about it. So,
yeah, you know, it was a great, what, 5-year run? No, I guess 7 years. They kept him for 2 more years. But it had a great 7-year run. A lot of memories.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, John, I appreciate it, man.
Thank you, Brian. Take care.
Take care. Have a good one.